It's Wednesday, October 18th, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a new social media policy at the New York Times. We'll talk about why the paper's executive editor thought it was time to tighten the reins. We'll also talk about how KMOX Radio helped its sister station in Las Vegas during coverage of last week's mass shooting and whether it was ethical in its approach in doing that. And just how hard is it to read a script on television? For some, it's harder than you might think. Stick with us to the bottom of the hour and you'll get a better sense of what we mean by that. But first, let's revisit the big story from last week and the developments we've seen since then. Each day, we're hearing new allegations of sexual harassment, assault against Harvey Weinstein. And while he spends time in rehab for what he's calling a sexual addiction, members of both the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, you know, the one that gives out Oscars, and the Producers Guild of America have expelled Weinstein. There have been a lot of moving parts in this story this week. I wish I could have been a fly on the wall in Saturday's meeting of the Motion Picture Academy and that decision to expel him.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much they had to do what they had to do, but there was some concern about what kind of backlash there would be since there were other famous celebrities, directors, who have not been punished in the past for things that were just as egregious. So we'll see how that plays out. But they pretty much had to act. They followed on BAFTA, the British, you know, organization that represents filmmakers. So they kind of had to do it. And you see all the reporting. What was interesting to me, Amy, was how even the Hollywood press, maybe especially the Hollywood press, was just awash with stories about this. And, you know, you could argue that maybe for a long time, part of the problem was that the Hollywood press and the other, and the New York-based media didn't do this story.
Yeah, but that's what my takeaway from this is, that there had to have been some knowledge on the part of anyone who's covered Hollywood for a long period of time that this was going on, especially when you see the number of women who've come out who and spoken about his behavior toward them personally or to or friends of theirs. And then now all of a sudden these stories are coming out and it's like, wait a minute.
Well, and in fact, one of the journalists who's been most prolific in talking about that, especially since this past weekend, has been Janice Min, who was one of our Missouri Honor Medalists just last fall, talking about some of the experiences she's had personally or stories that reporters had brought to her that hadn't quite been ready to go yet or that they would have felt comfortable running at the Hollywood Reporter.
And that's one of the things that's really baffling to me is when they say the story wasn't ready to go. Mm-hmm. We weren't sure whether or not we were ready to publish it. Well, I mean, for the number of women who have come out saying that he was doing these things, how much more verification do you need? I mean, I'm questioning whether we're talking about, you know, was the story ready to go, or was there fear that the potential lawsuits were going to that he may have filed against news organizations is what basically kept him from doing this.
Potential lawsuits, or even another angle. We talk so often about the sports networks or television networks and how reluctant they are to push on the NFL. How about the fact that his studios are also large advertisers on behalf of the movies that he'd be producing in some of this Hollywood press?
I mean, I think a part of it was that somebody had to break the dam. Right. And it ended up being the New York Times and the New Yorker. It could have been NBC News. Right. Could have been. They had the initial run on this thing, but somebody had to take the first step forward. And since then, the story has really snowballed. I mean, you had on our Links blog, for example, a piece by Kim Masters, mm-hmm. who's a Hollywood reporter. And she was complaining about the fact that a story she was doing on an executive at Amazon Studios was not getting anywhere. And here we are a week later, and she's talking about how that story has been published and the kind of feedback she's getting. So somebody had to just take the first step, and it had to be a news organization that was willing to risk the possibility of lawsuits and the other threats that were being made.
So you had brought up other places potentially working on this. There is another media angle on this media story, this one that kind of circles around NBC contributor Ronan Farrow. So there were two big stories that came out 2 weeks ago, one in the New York Times, one in the New Yorker. The one in the New Yorker carried Farrow's byline. Apparently, though, this is after he tried to get NBC News to run it and the network refused. There are some conflicting narratives here. Run us through the timeline of Farrow's reporting and NBC saying no.
I don't know the exact timeline, but Ronan Farrow had been working on it as a contract employee with NBC News for several months. And earlier this year, he got an interview with an actress who was later willing to come forward and make complaints. He had access for months to a tape that the New York Police Department had when they put a wire on an Italian fashion model,
yeah.
I believe it was, where basically Weinstein acknowledged that he had harassed this woman. He had other interviews that he was ready to go with, and NBC News decided, in fact, if you read some of the press about it and get some of the inside take from people who worked on the story, NBC News actively scuttled that story, and he ended up having to take it to the New Yorker, where after they ran it through their fact-checking process, they ran the story. But for months, NBC News had access to all this material and chose, for whatever reason, not to go forward.
Right, and you, no one knows what was going on behind the scenes, but you would have to think that it had to be some legal ramifications for this, the fact that Weinstein may sue them. But I think it also goes back to the point that you are talking about a media operation that has an entertainment division that deals specifically with Weinstein or Weinstein's companies, mm-hmm. or people
or
who
were his companies.
Or what were his companies. And that had to have had some bearing on whether or not they were going to make the decision to run the story.
And here's the problem for NBC News. Whether or not they actively squelched the story, a lot of people will believe that because the network also had access to the Access Hollywood tape before the Washington Post ended up running it with Donald Trump during the campaign. Saturday Night Live was really late to the party and doing any kind of jokes or commentary.
Well, and it
about
wasn't just
Weinstein.
Saturday Night Live. I mean, you had Saturday Night Live was late to it. All the late night talk show hosts, you can go down from Jimmy Fallon all the way to Jimmy Kimmel. I mean, they were days late before they dealt with Weinstein. I mean, that's the thing that really bothered me, was that they're quick to jump on other things, including the president. But then you have someone who's in their own wheelhouse, and they tend to want to say, "Whoa, wait a minute, we want to wait until we know more facts before we jump in."
It was ironic to me too that Ronan Farrow, the person who had the most emotional version of this story, mm-hmm. came out right after the New York Times. It's the son of Woody Allen mm-hmm. and Mia Farrow.
Right, right.
And Woody Allen comes out and steps in it by basically saying, well, we don't want there to be a witch hunt where people are innocently, you know, targeted for sexual harassment, when he, of course, has been accused of the same thing for years.
Well, and interestingly enough, there's a column from a year ago that Ronan Farrow wrote about reporting that he had done, and kind of his complicated position as the son of Woody Allen after the stories about Bill Cosby had first broken in the time of those charges and that trial, and the idea of allegations versus what is proven to be fact. Let's talk for a minute about how the sports division of NBC stepped in it. Sunday night, during the New York Giants-Denver Broncos game, Al Michaels said this.
And that is knocked down by Bradley Roby. I mean, let's face it, the Giants are coming off a worse week than Harvey Weinstein, and they're up by 14 points.
So for him to come out and say, while delivering commentary on the game, that the Giants are having a worse week than Harvey Weinstein. In a lot of cases, I would say, ooh, too soon that this was Sunday night, but this feels like, ooh, not appropriate ever.
Well, I actually heard that live. And
oh, did you?
I was standing in my kitchen, and the game was on in the background. And when he said it, I sort of just turned and looked at the television, and then I went and grabbed my DVR.
That was going to be my question. Do you have the ability to rewind live TV?
And I rewinded it and heard it again, and I went like, what are you thinking? Why would you say that? Out of all the things you could have said.
Did you do a signature earnest prayer? No! No!
Something like that, yeah. Something like that. I don't understand. Don't understand. It's one of those things where I think announcers get going mm-hmm. and their mouth runs faster than their head, their mind. You know, it's amazing.
I don't know if he planned it or not. I know Chris Collinsworth, who was there in the booth with him, was totally taken aback and was trying to, only somebody with Hollywood experience or whatever would have that reference. And the network people obviously got to him, because while the the broadcast was still on, he came on and made this kind of haphazard, lame apology talking about, well, maybe I tried to be a little too flip or something like that. But I'm not sure that he really got the full import of what he was saying.
No, I think it was that he just got going and it popped in his head and he said it. And you see more and more of that from sports announcers now, but it's mainly done on when they're doing replays or something like that, but you hardly see it in live. And then when you see it in live, you sort of go like, it sort of takes you aback.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons that it struck me, I mean, aside from just how completely inappropriate it is that it's also during an NFL game, which, as we've talked about how many times, we're talking about an entity and a brand that has had a really spotty relationship with its relations with women and how players have been accused in domestic violence cases and rape cases and harassment cases. And now we're making light of it and making a joke of it during a football game.
Right. I mean, the NFL has got so much going on right now, and that's one of the major things that's against it. So for him to come out and do that is just stunning.
Well, for the first week or so, the conversation swirled entirely around Hollywood and the people in Harvey Weinstein's circle. But this week, we saw that expand as women everywhere followed actress Alyssa Milano's call for any woman who had experienced sexual harassment or sexual assault to post a Facebook status with the hashtag #MeToo. And starting Sunday afternoon, feeds filled #MeToo after #MeToo after #MeToo. And every person and every person's story, every person's experience is real. And I've seen a lot of men say that they didn't realize just how widespread it was until they saw it from the perspective of women close to them, or at least women who are friends or acquaintances. It's an interesting piece, though, in our Links blog from the editor of the Huffington Post's Australia edition, who says that really a meme like this hurts telling real people's stories or perspectives.
I don't know that I would go that far. I mean, I get the point that if everybody is saying Me Too and you're equating, you know, a wolf whistle or a look to sexual assault, that maybe you could be watering down the stories of real people. But on the other hand, I haven't seen very many large societal issues that have gotten the kind of attention as rapidly as this one has. My concern is less that we water it down by having too many people on social media. It's that, will this be ephemeral, like a lot of other social media causes? Or will people stick with this and find ways beyond the Me Too hashtag to do something?
Right. I'm hoping that people do find a way past the Me Too and actually start to deal with this as an issue that has been out there, and it in many ways hampers women's ability to be able to achieve full equality. I mean, and I think it will, because if you look at the names of the women who have come out and are openly talking about this and are really pushing this, if they continue to do that, then I think you're going to see some traction here.
I just hope, though, that the social media, which allowed such a coming together around this topic so quickly, isn't also used to divide the people who are interested in this. I mean, you brought it up, Amy, in on the Links blog, there's a post about people saying, well, Alyssa Milano doesn't deserve credit for launching the Me Too
hashtag. Let's talk about this for a second. And that was going to be the next point I wanted to bring up, is Alyssa Milano has been credited with this because she's brought it up and made it a widespread thing. But the Me Too hashtag actually originated more than a decade ago.
Right.
And this is a discussion that was part of a conversation that I had moderated earlier this week, and that very oftentimes some of the leaders of the feminist movement who are most quickly and easily forgotten are the women of color who are paving the way. And the Me Too hashtag, also created by a woman of color more than a decade ago, who wanted to bring attention to this. And it wasn't that anybody listened until Alyssa Milano, who became famous on Who's the Boss, took the attention.
You know, I see this from both sides. I mean, I get it. And I think that, you know, the fact that there was finally some focus on Tarana Burke, I believe is her name, who started up the campaign 10 years ago, There wasn't a hashtag at the time. Right. But I mean, she did have a campaign, and it was basically of sexual assault victims supporting each other, and nobody remembers it. It's kind of, I mean, how many examples of whitewashing can we point to? I mean, just look at the movies. Everybody remember Hidden Figures that was out not that long ago? The women from NASA, right. The black women who right. got, history forgot them if they right. ever knew anything about them at all. On the other hand, if we're going to start dividing, well, the actress Alyssa Milano is getting heat because she expropriated somebody else's campaign. As soon as she found out about Tarana Burke, she mentioned her.
She
linked to stories about her. So,
I mean, I think we get caught up in that, and we aren't paying attention to the larger issue, which is the continued second-class citizenship, which manifests itself in sexual harassment, unequal pay, not being able to access the good paying jobs, all of those issues that impact women daily. Those issues get lost when we start talking about the issues that divide women along class lines, racial lines, sexual preference lines. When we go down that road, we don't get to the real issues that unite.
Okay, well, interestingly, this is all happening at the same time that the New York Times is asking its editorial employees to rethink how they're using social media. Executive editor Dean Baquet introduced a new social media policy to the newsroom last week. At its center, be careful about what you tweet about the president. What are some of the nitty-gritty details in here?
Well, so first of all, the reason they put it out, or at least the reason that Dean Baquet said that they were doing it, is because if journalists at the New York Times are perceived as being biased or perceived as engaging in editorializing, that it's going to undercut the credibility of the newsroom. And we're at a time when journalists in these mainstream news organizations are needed now more than ever. So the policy in some ways just reinforced what they were doing before. But some of the specific things are to say that journalists should not be appearing to take sides in any of their social media. All social media, personal media, as well as company hashtags or company accounts, that you should not join private or secret groups on Facebook that might be perceived by others as having a partisan orientation. Basically, they're trying to say, we're covering the news seriously. Don't mess it up by being appearing to be partisan.
Right, and I think part of this goes back to, if you remember, I think we talked about this last week, the Jemele Hill incident. I think a lot of it goes back to that, where you're starting to see news organizations continue to say, look, you know, we've got to really work a little bit harder on making sure that we aren't showing any kind of opinion that damages our credibility.
I actually, there were some other points that I thought were pretty interesting as well. So one was that these guidelines, they say, apply to everyone in the news department, not just to the reporters out in the field covering politics, but anyone working in the newsroom at all has to abide by these rules. And there are some people, largely people on the left, who are saying the New York Times is somehow throttling their journalists, caving in to Trump right. pressure or whatever. But it seems to me that these guidelines are trying to enable the newsroom to do its aggressive journalism as well as it can, and trying to minimize as much as it can the criticism.
The criticism right. or the detractions from right. being able to right. do that. Speaking of the president, it's been another week in which he's been slightly less than pleased with the news media. This time it was NBC he was particularly upset with, and he put a tweet out there saying that with all of the fake news coming out of that network, he wanted to know at what point it's appropriate to challenge the network's license. It's not likely to happen, though, and we'll talk about why in a second. But first, take a listen to this reaction from an FCC commissioner. This woman was appointed by former President Barack Obama.
History won't be kind to silence, and I think it's important for all the commissioners to make clear that they support the First Amendment and that the agency will not revoke a broadcast license simply because the president is dissatisfied with the licensee's coverage.
So what she's saying here is just because the president is upset about the coverage doesn't mean that you can have a license pulled by the FCC.
No, you can't do that. This is another attempt on the part of the president to stoke up his base against the press by saying, hey, you know, if these guys don't clean up their act, if they don't stop producing this fake news, if they don't start towing the company line, then, you know, we're going to try to come up with some ways in which to curtail their ability to do their job. And that's just not going to happen.
I'm afraid this is one of those stories where the media are being led around by the nose ring because the president doesn't know or care about this. I mean, if he knows, he knows that networks are not licensed. Local stations are licensed by the Federal Communications Commission. And it's very unlikely that anything that a network news organization does is going to lead a local station to have their license revoked because they were carrying that network programming. I mean, licenses are almost never revoked. I mean, there was a piece you had on our Links blog where they noted, an expert noted that in the past 20 years, only twice has a station's license been yanked for something that the local station did. One involved an owner of the station being convicted of child molestation, and the other one involved someone dying because they were taking part in a radio station contest. Those are the only times, never about politics. It is highly unlikely that it ever would be because
of politics.
Or any
kind of a First Amendment issue.
Right.
Really.
Right.
The other part of this here now that we're also starting to see, and until I believe it was yesterday, the chairman of the FCC had been quite silent on the issue, saying yesterday he believes in the First Amendment, that being pretty much his only comment on this. Democrats in Congress aren't too happy about this, and some are calling for hearings in Congress. What is that going to actually accomplish?
It's not going to accomplish anything. I mean, I go back to what Mike says. Yeah. I mean, there's no way that they're going to yank a license because the president said so, because he wasn't happy with coverage. I mean, every president going back to when television first started covering the president has been at some point been unhappy about it. So I don't think I think these hearings are a waste of time, and it just becomes another story that the media has to cover because the president is upset.
And specifically with the Democratic reaction, which is really a non-story,
non-story.
But because we allowed the president to jerk our chain, now we've got to show balance by covering the Democrats.
Okay, well, this next topic comes to us from a member of our audience. Michael, I'm sorry, I don't have your last name, but you emailed me on Friday and brought this to our attention. A few weeks ago, KMLX in St. Louis offered a hand to its sister station in Las Vegas, helping out with the coverage of the mass shooting at the Jason Aldean concert. This wasn't the type of help, though, that we've talked about that we lended to WLRN, where we were doing remote reporting, or that we talked about during some of the other hurricane situations where producers or master control operators were working in a different city. In this case, KMOX was originating all of the Las Vegas coverage from St. Louis. The actual reporting and anchoring of the newscasts, the journalism was going on in St. Louis, not in Las Vegas. And the audience never knew about that.
Yeah, the audience should have been told about that. I mean, that's difficult to do, is to basically run your news operation from thousands of miles away and make it appear as if it's happening right then and there. And not tell your audience, that's unethical.
It is unethical. It's also really interesting to me because of the reasons behind it, or at least the stated reasons for it. So the news station, radio station in Las Vegas has few employees, right? They've been cut. And a couple of people, I believe, were fired for various offenses.
Some of them for cause that had nothing really
So their staff was short, and they'd been working all night and through the morning on this story. And so they decided that they needed a break. And I think it was from 9 a.m. the morning after the shootings until 1 p.m. Vegas time, the KMOX staffers from St. Louis were doing the story. How could they get away with it without the audience knowing? Well, my guess is that one, a whole lot of people were paying attention to television at that time, not radio, in the immediate aftermath, wanting to see all the video, but also because so much of that local coverage, I imagine at the moment, was really the same coverage as the national networks were giving, as the wire services were giving. They were the police briefings and all of the stuff that we do in the hours immediately after something like this happened. So maybe the public didn't notice it at first.
I'm interested to find out how did it come to the attention of the person you emailed and others that KOMX did.
Well, there was a column that was in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that he had read and that he had forwarded to us to let us know about that. One of the things, though, that does worry me a little bit, take the breaking news aspect of this out of play. And we've talked about this a little bit in the past as Sinclair television stations have moved to some centralized news hubs. I can understand doing a little bit more of this in breaking news situations, but it worries me that if management can see that it works in a breaking news situation, what if we were to try doing more of this in controlled settings too?
Yeah, and I don't like the fact that the reason they gave was basically that their staff was exhausted. Hey, tell that to the people working in, you know, in Miami or Houston or whatever, covering the hurricanes. Tell that to all the other staff in Vegas that was covering this story. And I just really worry that we're going to use this as an excuse from now on. It's one thing to supplement. Remember we talked on the show about in Houston, one of the stations was having trouble, and so the, their sister stations were sending employees down to help them with coverage.
But the reporting was being done
on
locally.
Site.
Exactly. Right. It was being done locally. People were going to that location and doing the reporting there. Well, before we go, one last chapter for this week from the NFL announcers acting badly file. But this one is a little bit different.
On the Visa halftime report, Kurt Terry, Howie, Michael, and Tony look on graphic for the final two bullet points.
So someone, sorry, go ahead, Ernest, have your reaction.
What the what?
Okay, so somebody handed him a script, and he read it verbatim. What that script was meant to say was, look at the screen for the information, and then read the screen to the audience. But kind of like that movie Anchorman, I'm Ron Burgundy.
Well, I mean, go ahead, Mike.
I don't know. I mean, so Dick Stockton is a very
and
revered.
And been on the air forever.
Yeah, he's been on, and that maybe that's part of it. He's been around for a long, long, long time. But also, we don't really know how the script was written.
Right.
It may have been his fault. It may have been the person who wrote the script and didn't note it properly. We'll never know, but it sure comes off as sounding like Ron Burgundy.
I mean, and he is Dick Stockton, like I said, he's been on the air forever, and he's gone through a lot of these. You think he would have kind of, but I guess if you're in the middle of reading it and you're trying to get it on the air before the next play shows up, then you're gonna run into it like, oh, okay. So,
but
he
like
kept going. He kept going, which was great.
I've got to say though, you know, hats off to him compared to Al Michaels. I mean,
I'd rather have.
Fortunately for Dick Stockton, his thing happened the same time Al Michaels' thing happened.
Right. And I think oftentimes I think it's one of those where you know you've gone through the motions, you're doing this, and then all of a sudden there's some sort of a hiccup, and you kind of go, oh, why did I do that? But you got to keep going, you know? So you just keep going at it. I mean, it's amazing.
You just keep going.
It makes me happy that when we do this show, usually it is not live. So when we're reading the teleprompter, if we happen to screw up, we can go back and do it over again.
We can, but you know, it's not that hard. Mike, you talk about people walking and chewing gum at the same time. I'm about to run my own teleprompter and remind you that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. For those of you who have watched us on Facebook Live today, we hope you enjoyed this experiment. We'll let you know when we'll be doing it again. Until then, give us a like or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions. See previews of what we'll be talking about next week and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music, and Chelsea Preby and Alec Corin are our associate producers. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next time.